Good morning. Barack Obama has been on my mind a lot lately. And I'm not someone who is involved with politics intensely. So today what came to me about him that I wanted to begin with. we normally call him a black man. The fact is that his mother is white and his father is black. So he is as white as he is black, if we're thinking in terms of where the white came from and where the black came from. We normally call him American. His mother was American and his father was Kenyan. So he is as American as he is Kenyan. He was born in Hawaii, but we say he is from Chicago because he lived in Chicago for the past 20 years, I think. But the previous 27, he lived in Hawaii, he lived in California, he lived in Massachusetts, he lived in New York. So we have all of these labels that we put on Barack Obama. We do this with everyone. I'm just using him as an example because he's a very good example. And yet, the American people who voted for him did not, in general, did not vote for him because he was black, because he was from Chicago, because he was born in Hawaii, because his father was Kenyan, because his mother was from Kansas, because he went to Harvard, because he plays basketball. These were not why people voted for him, generally. Some people did not vote for him for some of those reasons, but not only. Some people didn't like what he said. They didn't agree with his politics. He himself never talks about race. Once he did, in last year, he made a very famous speech about, because he was pushed to, about race in America. But otherwise, it's not an issue. He is what people are now calling post-racial, which means that the racial issue embodied by him has been transcended. If we call him black, we miss his whiteness. If we call him white, we miss his blackness. I can say something like that. Now I give him as an example, a very concrete example that we can all see quite easily. The same thing, however, can be said about a book. We can say, if you call this a book, you miss the nature of it. You miss its true nature. If you don't call it a book, you miss its reality. It's a book, right? And this relates to another question that has been an issue for many, many years for me and for many, probably all practitioners in the West, but probably practitioners throughout time, I don't know, and for all of us in our daily lives, but we approach it differently, is this issue of form, ritual, appearance, structure, position, container, all these sorts of issues. Every time that Buddhism and Buddhism itself is already using that word, even is already a form. We're already getting form into something that doesn't have form, is formless. Every time that it has moved, has been received by a different person, it takes a different form. Each one of us embodies it in a different way. And so we can say that about individual people, but we can also say that about groups of people who embody it in different ways. We can also say that about different cities. It embodies itself different in different cities, different countries, different cultures, different centuries. It always is different, because that is the reality of all things. There is diversity. Everything is different. Everything manifests in a different way. And to be attached to have an idea that it should remain, it should always be embodied as it was in someone 2,500 years ago, is to miss, it's like calling this a book and missing its, what's inside it, what is written on these pages. To not call it something, to be attached to not calling it something, or not having a form, is the same thing as being attached to a specific form. There's still this duality. To not call Barack Obama black is to miss the fact that he's a black man. And part of the fact that he was, that his election has created such excitement is because that's an enormous step for America, to millions of white people, to vote for a black man. The thing is, they didn't vote for him because he was black. So it's both. So to focus only on the forms is to miss the point, as we were saying yesterday, is to miss the teaching. To focus on an absence of form, to want to eliminate form, to reject form, is also an attachment to form, and is missing the teaching. There's a famous sutra called the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is the story of a rich Indian man in the time of the Buddha, a wealthy businessman, not a businessman like you think of today, driving around in Mercedes with factories and stock options and an investment banker or something. But within the context of his society, he was an eminent person in the culture and lived very well. And yet, according to the Buddha, he had the most clear realization of anyone. He embodied the teachings for the Buddha better than anyone. But he was a lay person. He was not a monk. the Buddha would regularly send his disciples there because he said, Vimalakirti knows better than anyone. Go see him, go talk to him, go ask him questions. And so all sorts of famous people would go and see Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti was often sick. He was very sickly, although that didn't stop him from maintaining his life and from discussing with people the teachings. So one of the Buddha's greatest disciples, Sariputra, who is often cited in the sutras, came to see him, came to see Vimalakirti, and arrived in this very modest room. Vimalakirti in his bed, sick, and one chair in the room. And Shariputra said to him, actually Shariputra was thinking, how can this be? Where are all the magnificent chairs that there should be for all of the magnificent people who come to hear these teachings? There's no room in here for those chairs, and there is only one chair, and it's all very simple. Vimalakirti got what Shariputra was thinking, and he said, Shariputra, did you come for the chairs, or did you come for the teaching? We are all amused by this, right? But can we ask ourselves that? Did we come for the chairs? Did we come for the forms? Did we come for the absence of the forms? Did we come for the absence of the chairs? Or did we come for the teaching? What did we come for? And then Shariputra said, I came for the teaching. I didn't come for the chairs. And Vimalakirti goes into quite a long discourse, but he ends by saying, if you came for the teachings, you will see it in nothing. There doesn't have to be anything special. You will see it wherever it is, and it's everywhere. And to be attached to, meaning to have an idea that it has to be presented in a specific way, either in a very strict, traditional, whatever your idea is, form, or in the absence of all of that, is to miss the teaching. And Vimalakirti, like Barack Obama, embodied this in the sense he was a layperson, and the trend at that time was if you wanted to follow the Buddha, you left your life, you left your home, you had no possessions, you had no money, you became a monk, and you wandered around and begged for food and studied with the Buddha. Vimalakirti did not do that, and the Buddha said he was the most realized of all the disciples. So Vimalakirti embodies also this. He has a form. We all are sitting here because we are have form. We are form. He does not deny that form, Vimalakirti. He even goes to the extent of always being sick. He is so much in that form that he's sick all the time. And when they asked him why he was sick, he said, I am sick because all of humanity is sick. I am the same as everyone else. I asked Claudia to give me my book because I knew I would forget some of the things I wanted to say. Yes, okay. And Vimalakirti even goes so far as to say, in his talk about not being attached to the chairs, he also says, don't be attached to the Buddha, don't be attached to what we say, the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Dharma is the teaching, the Sangha is the group, the other practitioners, and the Buddha is the awakened one. So Vimalakirti even goes to that point, he's that radical, saying, that's not the point either. That's not what it's about either. And to deny that is also to be attached to the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. As soon as we have an attachment to one or the other, we're stuck. And another way that this manifests in a very concrete way is through language. As I said, if we, as soon as we call it Buddhism, then we're starting to fix something. As soon as we say man, we become fixed. As soon as we say stone, we become fixed. Fix it is something. So a practice that I sometimes give people is a language practice. While you are sitting and a thought comes up or a sensation or a sound, you seek to identify that, to name that, whatever it is, but in a language that you don't know. So you choose, before you begin the practice, you say, okay, I'm going to identify all phenomena, all things that manifest during my sitting in a language I don't know, say, Turkish or Swahili. We'll stay with Barack Obama. Barack means blessing in Swahili. So I will identify everything that appears as I'm sitting in Swahili. The only word I know in Swahili is Barak. So I will, that's my practice for half an hour while I'm sitting. Well, you think of this, you say, well, this is absurd. This is impossible. Yes, but it's always impossible to identify whatever comes up. I'm calling this a stone, but that's not what it is. I just have to call it something, so I chose this word stone. We've all agreed that this is called stone. In Portuguese, you have another word for it. And you've all agreed that that's the word for this. So, I'm doing the same thing. I'm attempting to identify, but in a language that I don't know. So a thought comes up, or a feeling, and I'm thinking Swahili. I don't know. I don't know what to call this. My knee. I don't. In English, I know that's knee. In French, I know it's genou. I don't know Swahili. Suddenly, everything becomes possible. Suddenly, the case, the shell that I have around everything, is cracked open. I don't know. I don't know what it's called. All I know is my experience of it. And that's all that you need to know, actually. That's where your freedom is. You're free to experience it as it is, without calling it black or white. we've almost forgotten that Barack Obama is black. And yet we see perfectly well that he's black. And the color of his skin is black. We can do this practice that I give of identifying things in a language I don't know. We can do that with ourselves. The point is to find what is true here. Not the identity, not the label, not the black or the white or the woman or the age or the place of birth, none of that. The IQ, the university degree, the job, the family status, divorced, married, single, none of that. And by choosing a language I don't know, I have a better chance of not focusing on and fixing on those aspects that I immediately label and then categorize, cling to. Attach to or reject. Now, it's also important to recognize that the forms, the rituals, someone asked me if the rituals had meaning for me, or said something like, I guess those rituals have meaning for you. And I was hesitant to respond because, in one sense, they have absolutely no meaning. The rituals mean nothing to me. What they mean is not what we think of as a meaning. For example, the bowing. There are all sorts of explanations. There are books written about bowing, and there are all sorts of commentaries on what it means to bow and how to bow, and every tradition has a certain way of bowing. And if you do this, it means something, and if you do that, it means something else, and there's all of this commentary and detail around bowing. For me, I use bowing as the same way as I do identifying something in a foreign language, in a language I don't speak. I renounce. I give up my idea about what I will do for the next 30 minutes before I sit down. I come in the beginning of the day, and it's true, this is a ritual. I do 3 bows as a way of entering the day and placing, giving up everything that I'm bringing to it that might limit me, that might keep me from opening and receiving whatever the day presents. I could do something else. There might be some other ritual or some other movement that would achieve the same goal or would represent that movement for me. It so happens that that's the movement that I learned and that works for me. And it has worked for a lot of other people too, and so I share that as a possibility of opening. That's one example. At the same time, form is absolutely fluid. As I said, it manifests differently in every one of us. We all have okay, we can make categories. There are men and women, and there are people of certain height and certain ages, and we can make all sorts of categories about the forms, but each one of these forms is different. Amazingly different. I mean, down to the, how do you say, the fingerprint, you know? The DNA. It's absolutely different. Every one of us is absolutely different. And it's always changing. So my hair changes color, my skin changes. I grow. We even say old people shrink. I change clothes. I eat. I have more weight or less weight. I'm sick or I'm not sick. It's always changing. And that's the same with every form. It's impermanent. Everything is impermanent. This stone, which we could think of, someone gave me this, we could think of it as being unmoving, unchanging. But it's not true. The stone is already different from when the person gave it to me. It's covered with my fingerprints, for one. And probably little bits of it have already come off because I've been touching it all the time. It's constantly changing. So it's the natural movement of all things is that's part of its nature. Everything's moving all the time. And I repeat this all the time when discussing the concrete practice of meditation, that it's not about not moving physically from this position. It's about not moving from this moment. And this moment is moving all the time. So it means not moving from something that is moving all the time, which implies staying in constant movement. But staying in constant movement, not running away from, but moving with, becoming the movement, which is what we already are. All it means is to stop fighting against the movement. So from the stone, which is a naturally occurring sculpture, right? Another one of my favorite topics is the sculptor, the Swiss sculptor Alberto Giacometti, who I'm not sure if I think of him as being really well known, and I can immediately hear the name Giacometti and I can immediately visualize his sculptures, but for those of you who don't know, he made for the latter part of his life, the last 20, 25 years of his life, he made these very long, thin, tall human figures in movement. One of the most famous, iconic figures of Giacometti is, the title in French is L'homme marchant, I don't know what is it? The walking man. And these figures they're reduced almost down to the wire. They're so thin. And they're always moving. There's always movement in them. And he died in, 1964, so this was after the Second World War until then, and that he was doing these figures. Although he had been a sculptor since he was quite a young man, he moved to Paris in the early 20s and at one point was involved with the Surrealist movement and famously was thrown out of the Surrealist movement by André Breton, who was the head of it, because he wouldn't adhere to their categories. He wouldn't adhere to the laws of the Surrealist movement, which for Giacometti, the Surrealist movement was focusing only on the form. was missing the non-form, was only, was taking forms and taking them out of their context and saying they are absurd. I'm simplifying it a bit. This was more or less it. For Giacometti, what interested in him was how can he reproduce, how can he present in sculpture, which is a very concrete art form, what is impermanent. He would sit in front of a model and look at the face, and it was constantly changing. He would spend the entire day with a sculpture, trying to reproduce what he saw before him. The next day he would arrive, and he would destroy it because the model was different. It was new. It changed. So he started again. And he did this day after day after day. Because it was impossible to reproduce impermanence. So we won't try. So we start again. And he even said, only an imbecile, only an idiot would try to do this. And yet he devoted his life to it. And what's amazing is he succeeded. When you see his sculptures, he said he was a failure. And he said all that interested him finally was to see, he was curious to see where he failed. Where the failure was exactly. But if you see his sculptures, that's what you see. You see impermanence. You see the absolute, how fragile all things are. And I say things, I mean plants, animals, planets, air, water, humans, all of it. Fragile in the sense that it's not fixed. It's always changing. And he managed to do that. He said he failed. He even made most of his sculptures in plaster, which is a very fragile material that is constantly falls away into powder. And most of them, he did not want them to be cast in bronze or another metal. Some other people did it. His brother, for example, would cast them, or after his death, some of them were cast. But for him, there was no point in casting it in bronze because it was impermanent. That was missing the point. The point for him was doing it, was trying, it was every day he got up and did it. He lived in a very modest, tiny little, not very nice studio in one of the artist quarters in Paris. During his lifetime, he had not much money, but he didn't care. That was not important. That was all impermanent, as were his sculptures, as were what he was looking at before him. So this is an example of these teachings, what I'm sitting here telling you, manifesting in in a way that we would not think normally of them manifesting. I think of Alberto Giacometti as a great Buddhist teacher. He's one of my greatest teachers. He would not call himself a Buddhist, and I don't call him a Buddhist either. The structure within which he manifested this reality was sculpture and some painting and drawing. But his paintings and drawings also manifest in the same way as his sculptures. And when he finally went, he was with the Surrealists for a few years, and then he went off and started doing drawings again, looking at models, because the Surrealists didn't even use models. That was considered academic tradition, and they were trying to break with that form. He went back to using models, and André Breton, the famous founder of the Surrealist movement, said to him, "What are you doing? This doesn't fit with our doctrine." And Giacometti said, "Well, I'm trying to see ahead. I'm trying to see a human head and reproduce it, draw it as it is." And Breton said, "Everybody knows what a head is." And Giacometti said, "I don't. I don't know what a head is." And left. Well, they threw him out in a public trial, but he also chose to leave. So we could sort of say that Breton and his interpretation of surrealism was an attachment to form, in fact. A fixed understanding of what a thing is and what a thing is not. Whereas the way that Giacometti was experiencing was, it was not fixed. It was the equivalent of looking at the head in a foreign language and trying to identify it in a foreign language, give it a name in a foreign language that he didn't speak. So I've gone on and on about the forms and the ritual and seeing through them. So what is the real point here? I said it's to see the true, what's inside the book, or what really is ahead. And beyond that, what is the point? What is the is that all? Is that all there is? And I'm using very dualistic and concrete words, forms of intellect, patterns of thought to address this issue, because that's how we communicate, as I said yesterday. So the point is to realize this true nature, to realize who this is, what this is. And when we realize that, we say that we have, that's wisdom, is to realize that when we talk about wisdom in this tradition. And the natural action born of that wisdom is compassion. Giacometti was endlessly moved by the fragility of how fragile everything was. To the point almost of being overwhelmed by it. And he was, because he saw that fragility in himself, he saw it in others, and he had enormous love for others and saw the beauty of everyone and everything and tried to reproduce that beauty. And the beauty, the impermanence is the beauty. The fact that we all will die is the beauty of each of our lives. That's the beauty of life, is that we will die. This utter impermanence, fragility, vulnerability, that's the beauty. And Giacometti's sculptures also are, there's this incredible sense of vulnerability that comes, that is apparent in these very thin, fragile figures advancing. The fact that they're walking is so moving. Just going on, step after step.
When you were talking about Giacometti, it felt like he was pursuing something. Now I think you made it clear. So he was pursuing something after knowing who he is. The question is, do you try pets, and by trying pets you find who you are, or do you have to know who you are and then find your own?
Well, I could say yes and no. I think Giacometti had a realization of his
formal nature.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He had no formal Buddhist practice, no Christian practice, no. His art was his practice. But there's no doubt in my mind from the things, from just seeing his work and also the things that he wrote and the things that other people wrote about him. And seeing, I saw a documentary in which he speaks and moves, and no doubt. Now, in which order did it occur? I don't know. He had a very strong experience when he was a young man. His father sent him to Italy to experience Italian art, to see the great classic works. And he was traveling with someone that he met, an older man who he had met traveling as well. And when they were in the mountains, crossing probably back to Switzerland, I don't know, on foot, the man died. And Giacometti was with him, by his side. They were alone together in the mountains somewhere when the man died. And this was a very formative experience for him, as we can imagine. And the story, the legend is that Giacometti never slept again at night with the lights off because he was so terrified from this experience of night, of darkness, of death. He also said that he had a very powerful experience in the cinema once when he was watching, this was later, probably 10 years later, watching a film, and suddenly realized that the film was a representation of, when he went out in the street, what he was seeing in the street. But what he was seeing in the street, he saw through, because he had seen this in the film, he saw through the forms in the street. He saw beyond the facade of the human form or whatever, and he saw the inner beauty. In order to have seen that, he had already seen it in himself. You can't see that elsewhere if you don't see it in yourself first. Whatever you see elsewhere is already, you're recognizing something that's in yourself. And from that point on, his art began to change. But he already was an artist that already was producing art and pursuing the same goal. Although he began to formulate it in a different way, and it became more clear to him after that experience. Now, in our case, the very fact that you are here means that you are seeking something. You may not be able to formulate to your satisfaction what it is you're seeking, or you may say, oh yes, I'm seeking peace of mind, but that doesn't really capture what you're seeking. Or you may say, I don't know who I am. Or you may say, I like to be relaxed. Or, I don't know, you may have something that you say, but you're seeking something by being here. And the only way to know whether this is your way, your path, is to do it. And if you really do it, one of two things will happen. Either you will realize that this is absolutely your way. This is my way. Or you will realize that this is not your way. This is not my way, and something else is my way. In order to know that, though, you have to do it. You have to really do it. Now, I've probably said this before, I don't know. I repeat myself all the time. Because there's only so much you can say. I'm always saying the same thing. And even if I repeat myself, I'm not really repeating myself, because it's a different day, it's a different group, it's a different word, it's a different moment. So that's the only way you can know if it's your way. There's no objective way of saying, well, this is my way and that's not my way. The fact that you're here is that you recognize something here, whatever it is. You recognize something about it that speaks to you, but you maybe don't know exactly what. But you can't do it as a dilettante. Because then you're not really doing it. Is it?
Yes.
So we say that there are two aspects to. When we talk about awakening or realization or seeing my true nature, whatever you want to call, whatever you want to call that, there are two aspects of it. There is the wisdom aspect, and there is the compassion aspect. The wisdom aspect is cultivated and pursued in sitting practice, and the compassion aspect is pursued in the world, in everyday life. We manifest this in the practice by sitting and then walking. The walking meditation is moving, getting up and running. I see lay practice. I'm not a monk. I have no monastic training. I have no monastic vows. I wear this robe, but this is not a monk's robe. I'm not a monk, a nun. As a manifestation of compassion. A monastic practice is more a wisdom practice, and a lay practice is more a compassion practice. Each one has manifests both, but one places more emphasis on the other, on another, on one of the aspects. Vimalakirti said to someone who was, actually it was the son of the Buddha, who was telling a group of people about the benefits of becoming a monk, of choosing the monastic life by leaving what he called the household life, which is the life in the world, the worldly life. And he himself, the Buddha's son himself, was a monk, and he was telling his people the benefits and the blessings of becoming a monk. And Vimalakirti heard him saying this, and he came to him and he said, "You cannot talk about the benefits and the blessings of leaving the household life. Because not having an attachment to benefits and blessings, renouncing benefits and blessings, is leaving the household life. What needs to be left is our attachments to getting something, obtaining something, possessing something, becoming something. Normally that's associated with the household life. That's associated with having a family, having a job, going to parties, going to museums, eating nice food, having a car. Normally an attachment to obtaining, possessing is associated with that. And therefore, someone who gives up those attributes, that form of life, we say, has given up wanting to obtain, to become, to accomplish. But, as Vimalakirti is pointing out, it's not the forms that need to be dropped. It's not the attributes that needs to be dropped. It's the attachment that needs to be dropped. And the attachment to obtaining, to becoming, to achieving. A monastic lifestyle can also be as, a monk can be as attached to achieving, becoming, obtaining. There are different things he wants to obtain, become, and accomplish. Or she.
This wish to achieve, it's a fair attachment for the beginning of the house.
What do you mean?
As to begin the practice, it's quite important to have a motivation. If it's an attachment to achieve enlightenment, I think somehow
yeah.
It's a better attachment.
Mm-hmm. That's a judgment. Yeah. Yeah. This is true. We always have attachments to things, and we always have goals, and we always have desires. Hmm? Yeah. In order to come in here and sit down every, sit here for 2 hours, obviously we have some desire, some goal, some What? Right, this is part of the nature of life, you know?
And what's this here? It's attachment. Why are we, why all of us are here? Is this attachment or not attachment?
It's not formulated in those terms. We each have our particular reasons for being here. And it's necessary to have those reasons. If I didn't have the desire to come here and teach, I wouldn't be here. So I have a goal of coming to Portugal, reserving my airplane ticket, organizing this retreat. Or other people organized it, actually. I did not organize it. But supporting them and suggesting that they organize it and helping them in whatever way I can. If I didn't have that goal, I wouldn't be here. And as you know, I sort of, when Isabel said it's a better goal than wanting a beautiful car, I point out the duality of that. But in relative terms, we can say it's better to want to do good than to do harm, right? The goal of coming here is a goal of wanting to realize some path of liberation. We're not seeking to enslave ourselves. We're not seeking to abuse ourselves, we're seeking to heal ourselves. So we can say yes, and there are differences. Absolutely, we have to recognize there are differences. And there are, if we plant an apple seed, an apple tree will grow. If we don't plant an apple seed, an apple tree won't grow. There's a difference. What Vimalakirti is pointing out is that we can have this desire to awaken in the household world, in living the household life. The benefits and the benefactions are not limited to monastic life. And the absence of attaining and becoming is not limited to the monastic life, and the desire to obtain and possess is not limited to the household life. And in Vimalakirti's statement, he's not making a judgment about monks and lay people. It's the opposite. He's actually trying to open it so that all is possible, and that whoever, wherever they are, whoever they are, has this opportunity, and it can manifest in innumerable ways. Did you have something? No? No.
I was listening to you.
What is illumination?
What is enlightenment?
How I can be in touch
How can I grasp enlightenment or take enlightenment as a goal for my life? If in reality we human beings.
I don't know what
is enlightenment. We don't.
Travel, I like to catch the sun, to travel, to
Relationship between the enlightenment and Zazen, and what does it have to do with Zazen?
So the question is sort of, well, what is enlightenment? Is that something like that? Or? Generally, something like that? I mean, it sounded like that. Well, there are some people who would say Zazen is enlightenment. Other people would say delusion is enlightenment. As soon as we start categorizing and defining and naming, the truth is you cannot be attached to enlightenment because then it's not enlightenment. It's like, you know, saying as soon as you call Barack Obama black, you miss his whiteness. As soon as you call him white, you miss his blackness. Things are as they are. And we don't see them, and when we do see them, it's different. So, you know, enlightenment, we could say, is just seeing things as they are, without, it's, you know, seeing them in this foreign language that we don't know. Not fixing it with some identification. Not categorizing, not rejecting, not attaching, what it is. Not making a difference between illusion and enlightenment, or sitting or walking, or everything is it. Everyone will experience that in a different way, that's true. But the content of that experience will be the same. The only thing that we have in common, the only thing we share, is our differences. So each of us will experience a moment, a flower, a person, an event, in a different way. In that moment of being one with myself, being seeing my true nature, experiencing myself as I truly am, the content of that experience is the same as every other person who has had that experience. But each of us is a different person.
Sure,
that's true. But the content of the experience of oneness, or what some was talking about enlightenment, of the enlightenment experience, is the same. It's the same experience of the Buddha, that the Buddha had, or Christ. And multitudes and multitudes and multitudes of people. It's the same content, but each of us would formulate that in a different way.
For instance, can we also, we all know what is a retreat, although we at different retreats here on the same
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we all experienced it, we got it.
You were all here, you all.
Yeah. But if each of us describes it, we're different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a way that it manifests. It's a metaphor for it.
Is that a question? I want to comment on something. Yesterday during the evening meal, we were silent, and there was another group that made an enormous racket. With music and everything, they were also doing a retreat. They were doing their own practice. Maybe in another form.
Mm-hmm.
The difference that I felt is that that we were able to feel their presence, and but maybe they didn't feel our presence,
or maybe they did. Yeah, that's true. And that reminds me of the story of when Christ came, in English we say Palm Sunday, when he arrived. How did you say that? Do you call it? On Palm Sunday, when he came back to.
And then before
what?
Yeah.
He was entering the city and then Palm. Yeah. And there's one version of it. Popularized version of it says as he's coming, the Roman soldiers are around, very menacing, and they're trying to threaten him. And he says to them, "You can shut me up, but if you do, the rocks and stones will keep talking." It's always being said. It's always manifesting. Everywhere. And it's true. We can try to shut people up. We can try to deny it. We can try to. There are battles raging all over the world at this very moment about who's saying it the right way and who's saying it the wrong way. One of the most moving things about Jerusalem, if anyone's been there, is how. It's just unbelievable that these two peoples, the Arabs and the Jews, should be fighting each other so bitterly, because it's so clear when you go there that they are one, they're brothers. They're as we all are. But it's so obvious there. When you're walking down the street, you can't tell who's an Arab and who's a Jew, unless it's an Orthodox Jew dressed in a particular way, or an Arab dressed in a particular way. The way you can tell is because the Arab quarters are very poor and dirty, and the Jewish quarters are rich. But other than that, you can't tell. And you're walking on stones that have been, for centuries and centuries and centuries, have been walked on by Christians, Jews, and Arabs, and sacred places, you know, the Western Wall, is also a wall of this sacred, one of the most sacred sites in Islam. It's the same wall. It's the same stones. It's just unbelievable to witness it. And that's the truth of everything. There's a book from an American, from Joseph Goldstein, an American Dharma teacher, Buddhist teacher, called One Dharma. There's only one teaching, and everybody's teaching it. Everything is teaching. Everyone has a different way of saying it, of experiencing it. They have different rituals, they have different names, different founders, but it's just one teaching. And I choose to, I'm constantly trying to distill that, to say it in the clearest, most obvious way for Westerners. This is my constant work, and it's unending, and I haven't succeeded. I'm like Giacometti, I fail all the time, but that is my goal, and that's what I do every single day, every moment, every retreat, constantly. My writing is that, my teaching is that, everything is that, my daily life, that's what I'm trying to do. And often what I come up with is, which is the same thing that the Christ said, which is the name that my teacher gave me when I engaged on this path. Some of you know this already because I regularly talk about it. Because it is such a distillation of what this teaching is. She called me Tu es cela in French. Tu es cela, I'll translate it. In English, it's you are that. It's an old Sanskrit Vedantist term that predates Buddhism, in fact. I think it's Tat Sam Svahi in Sanskrit. And it probably predates Vedantist teachings because it's the absolute, it's the ultimate truth of life. You are that. Christ said the same thing. You are the way. I am the way, but it's the same thing as you are the way. No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I am not as evolved as Christ. So for me, I needed to hear it in a specific way. But ultimately, it's the same thing. Because you and I are one. So if I am the way, you also are the way. No, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
In the search of knowing, of things and of ourselves, what is the value of faith, of belief? Is this necessary? Does it help?
Que tivessem chegado a um autoconhecimento, a iluminação, é a
Pensate aussi que je suis un philosophe. People, what is the word for pensador?
Thinkers.
Okay. What I think is that by this way of thinking, they've reached a certain knowledge. Is that what you
saying?
Without faith. Trouble. I just missed the word pensador and I got confused. So, are there people who through the way of thinking reached a certain knowledge if there's no faith involved? Is it possible?
How would you define faith in that?
Spirituality is not the same thing as religion. The divine. The divine, the absolute, the faith in the absolute.
Mm. Okay. And so the question is, are there people who have realized the absolute without having faith in it, or?
The question is, quelle est l'importance de la religion?
Religion.
Oui, le besoin de croire.
What is your faith to achieve realization?
Is it necessary? Is faith necessary or essential, or what is its role? I wanted to know what you meant by faith, because we all have different definitions about it too. Faith in some sort of concrete material entity will not achieve freedom from, or will not, you will not realize the absolute if that's the kind of faith we're talking about. Because then we will be focusing on something concrete and something material in which we have faith. And this realization of the absolute, or the what is not seen, or the formless, or the true nature of things, is not the nature of, is formless. So we can't have faith in something in some form and realize the formless. However, faith is essential in any sort of authentic practice of realization. Faith is essential, and particularly, and there's a book that someone was just talking about the other day, which I really like the title, although I haven't read the book, The Faith to Doubt. Because what's essential is this doubt. When I'm saying you take a language that you don't know and try to identify things, you are doubting. That's a form of doubt, of doubting everything you know about an object, about reality, about the people around you, what you're seeing. You're doubting it. And you need a lot of faith to doubt. Not faith in something. We can't say what it is, but it takes faith to do that. That's true. To come in here and sit down every day, you have some sort of faith. You can't say really what it is, but there's some sort of faith involved, or you wouldn't be doing it. And it's not so important at an initial stage to know what you have faith, what that faith is. You don't necessarily need to define it. Because then as soon as you're defining it, then you say, okay, I have faith in the teacher, I have faith in the sitting, I have faith in the people who are with me. Well, then when the teacher's not there and the people aren't with you and it's not this room, you don't have faith anymore. Your faith is linked to something material. And that will only take you so far. It can be a help. But ultimately, you need that faith to doubt the teacher, to doubt the form, to doubt the teaching, to doubt everything. But that's you don't have to experience that now. It's just taking you far into the depths of faith and doubt, which seem contradictory. But in fact, in order to really doubt, you need deep faith. Does that help or no?
Yes. What about why we should research the name of Jesus Christ? Another some kind of divine. I think we have
necessity.
We need to someone or something which can integrate the absolute. I ask if this is true, if we really need to search the absolute, the knowledge about this kind of thing. That's the really question.
Do we need to?
Do you need to meaning? It helps.
Well, on the one hand, I would say, no, if you can live your life without doing any sort of practice like this, do it. Because, you know, this is not easy. And you're in for a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. In this. So if you can do it without, fine. Do without. I encourage you. But if you feel this, you know, if something is not satisfactory in your life and this is what has appealed to you and this is something has drawn you here, trust that as well. When you first started speaking, just the second time, I thought, oh, okay, so it's true, we have people that we say, okay, they embody it, and we look towards them, and we're inspired by that. And that's necessary, absolutely. We have to realize, however, that it's like a boat that we're using to cross the river. And when we get across the river, we don't need to carry that around anymore, the boat. Those figures, why they inspire us, is because we aspire to that. But if we miss the fact that we also embody it, we also are divine. We embody the divine. We are divine. That's it. You are that. We use the other figures or the objects or whatever it is that, you know, Christians use the cross and the crucifixion. But if we limit it, comes back to these questions of forms and rituals, we miss the point if we only see that. It would be like, I often use the example of psychoanalysis. Freud had an office in Vienna, a certain kind of chair, a couch with a certain kind of tapestry on it. He smoked cigars, he had a beard, glasses. If we said psychoanalysis has to be only those, that the forms must be like that, then every psychoanalyst in the world would have that exact same couch and that exact same chair and smoke the exact same cigars and have a beard, and therefore women wouldn't be psychoanalysts, or they would have false beards that they put on when they sat in the chair, and they would have the glasses like him. I know this sounds absurd, but it's not really. It's only a hair distance from thinking that the entire Christian teaching is limited to that crucifix on the wall. It's not. That symbolizes something that is really alive.
But can't we consider faith as a tool, a normal tool? As, for instance, when I need to cut meat, I need a knife. Mm-hmm. So faith for me, it can be a tool, as any other tool,
yep,
to achieve something.
Exactly. Yep. And then at some point we have to have faith when we don't achieve it, and we have to have faith in the non-achievement. Are we addressing the question, or?
Almost.
Yeah. Should we keep trying? You will also accept failure in this case.
I don't understand. It's not a failure.
No. I'm joking.
The problem is I'm very complicated.
Me too.
As far as I know, I think I was born a faithful person. As far as I know. But what lately has been allowed to me to do with myself is begin to doubt. Is it the same thing?
Is faith and doubt the same thing? In some respects we could say so. We also have to recognize the difference, but as I said, in order to doubt, it takes enormous faith. Because you doubt that you have, ultimately you doubt even the ground under your feet. And that takes a lot of faith.
Courage.
Yeah, absolutely.
What occurred to me was the thought the way he was speaking.
And you're talking about Jesus Christ, the religion. And yesterday, when I was in the night,
I opened the soap.
I read priest Manuel Antunes.
I remember.
A priest, a friend, that helped me a lot in the last month. And he has the same name. And then I remember him. Okay? Today morning, I knew that the man died with a 70 years old, started with this house in 1960. This congregation. Yeah. Is the uncle of the man. Friend, priest. It's funny. And when I speak with him, he never told me, you don't do that, you don't do that, you don't do that. Never. Leave me alone. You know that I'm doing this practice. And last village.
2 weeks ago.
I went to do dinner. It's a retired spiritual retard. And he was mental. Mm-hmm. And his name is Habits in Religion, is my question. Because when the priest goes to give Austria, what is the same-wise, I don't know what same-wise yet, and where is he from, but same-wise, that is the body of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And in the prepure, the priest said in the desert in that retire, you must, it's not good to take the hostel. It's not good if you are not going every Sunday. So today is Sunday. And if you are as far as you mean,
if you're not there for one, if you miss one on Sunday,
you cannot miss it.
Closed. Mm-hmm.
Why you don't tell me to me that? Por que é que eu vi quando estamos sozinhos, não me diz a mim sozinha, mas em público, diz, considero fazer isso.
Why doesn't he say this to me personally, but he does say it in public, but in front of a lot of people?
Are you asking me? Waiting for the question. That was the question? No.
My question is?
Muitas vezes eu estou no
I often, whether it's spiritual, often I'm, when I'm in Zazen or I'm in the church, I'm making my own rules. What did you say?
Truth,
sorry, yeah.
It's correct. Because it's God, it's... The
religion
has 2,000,000 years, has...
Religion is 2,000,000, 2,000,000 years old. 2,000 years old.
The question is...
Say to this direction.
She's fighting for because it's being the Catholic church and also trying to learn this way and getting each other fighting because sometimes it's on court and she doesn't know what is the best way for her to
Mm-hmm.
Well, the, I refer to the Dalai Lama, who says, when he's speaking to Westerners and we have these kinds of questions, or also Thich Nhat Hanh, another very popular Buddhist teacher, who says, you know, I don't encourage people to leave their traditions that they are, if they are on a path, I don't encourage them to leave that and become Buddhist. This is a way of saying, stay with what is real for you, what is genuine for you, what is your way. Myself, I was not raised Catholic, so I can't really share that experience, that I can't really measure how important that is in the Portuguese culture. But the notion of is it this way or that way and the conflict, I can't appreciate. And we make these conflicts, they're self-generated conflicts.
But of course,
of course, there are Catholic groups that would reject, would say, no, you can't have a Zen practice. But there are, I know many Zen practitioners who also are Catholic practitioners. There are even Zen teachers in our lineage who are priests, nuns, rabbis, Sufi teachers, men and women, people who had no spiritual training before. It's all possible. Each one of us, however, has to experience that for ourselves. You know, the ritual of receiving of communion, it's called, right? When you receive the body and blood of Christ, right? Isn't that what it is, symbolizes it? The Protestant tradition that I was raised in, we don't have that. What does that mean for you? I mean, these are just quite, I mean, you don't have to answer them now. I'm just saying these are some of the things that you can look at. What does that mean for you? What does going to church every Sunday mean for you? What does coming on a Zen retreat mean for you? What does the practice of Zen mean? What is it that you're seeking in these different practices? And when I'm dealing with these forms, some people think this is pretty formal here. For other people, this is pretty loose and weird. And from the training that I had, this is sort of not very orthodox. But what I try to do is, okay, the forms that I was given, the practices that I was given, what is the intent? What am I intending to transmit in those forms and practices? And then I try to find a form or a practice that does that same thing, that has that same meaning. And not in a meaning in the sense that we normally think of it. The eating practice that we do here, it's not at all traditional. I completely invented it based on a traditional way of eating because I'm intending to transmit the same message through that we do in a traditional form. So a way that you can do it is look at what is it that you're seeking in these different forms and rituals and practices. You might find you're seeking the same thing. You might not. Okay, I think it's lunchtime. That's the best way to finish.